Case number 17-5098, St. Francis Medical Center et al. Appellants versus Eric D. Hargan, Acting Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Morrison for the appellants, Ms. Patterson for the appellees.
All right, Mr. Morgan.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Edgar Morrison, representing the appellant hospitals. My co-counsel is Stephen Calhoun. I have asked the marshal to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. There are three reasons that the court can and should rule in favor of the hospitals in this case. Number one, the 2013 amendment, by its own terms, does not apply to these hospitals, none of whom have requested a reopening of any final determination. Number two, even if the 2013 amendment is applicable to these statutory appeals, the rule as applied is arbitrary and capricious and contrary to the Medicare statute. And finally, and you only need reach this point if you agree that the rule prospectively applied is permissible. Even if it is permissible prospectively applied, it's contrary to the statute and to centuries of legal tradition to apply it retroactively to these hospitals, and the Secretary has failed to meet the two very narrow exceptions to that prohibition. And as I mentioned, should you agree with either of our first 2 points, there's no need to reach the retroactivity issue. First, with respect to the 2013 amendment, the 2013 amendment is an amendment to Section 405.1885, which is entitled Reopening a Contractor Determination or a Reviewing Entity Decision. It only applies to reopenings. The operative part of the regulation is found in subparagraph B2 Romanet I, and that's where the 3-year limit applies, and that only applies to, quote, a reopening made upon request. So none of these hospitals have requested a reopening. All of them have appealed to the Provider Reimbursement Review Board pursuant to the statutory authority of 1395-00.
You agree that this theory is inconsistent at least with the preamble, right? Is that fair?
That our theory.
Your theory.
I agree that our theory is inconsistent with the preamble. The way I would respond.
So you would have to show that the government's reading of the underlying regulation is unreasonable.
What we can show, Your Honor, is that the preamble doesn't determine whether the rule applies. It's the text of the regulation.
I understand,
itself.
But it might have interpretive significance.
And our point would be to the court that deference to the Secretary on this particular issue is unwarranted when his interpretation is plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the actual text of the regulation. And this court recently in the Kaiser case, which is an important case for this, made that very ruling that 1885, that the Secretary interpreted that regulation impermissibly.
If there's any difference in the deference we owe the agency when the regulation, as in the Kaiser case, was long before the actual application in the case, and in this case where the regulation is issued and in the very same Federal Register notice, the agency explains what it means. That is, if an agency decides to explain the meaning of a rule that was passed 10 years ago, and it might seem inconsistent on its face. Is that different? Do we owe a different deference where the agency is explaining the very rule it is now adopting?
I don't think that the agency can satisfy its obligations to clearly apply the rule simply by stating in the preamble a statement that's inconsistent with the text of the regulation itself. I don't think that the fact that it's...
I guess the question is, in our determination of whether it's inconsistent or not, do we owe a little more deference when it's done at the very same time the rule is issued?
I'm not aware of any authority for that, Your Honor. I would argue that the contemporaneous nature of it actually probably mitigates against the Secretary's interpretation, rather than this being something that we, 10 years later, come up with a theory about. This is actually at the very moment when the Secretary had the opportunity to very clearly publish a regulation, he didn't do so clearly. And as a reminder...
So it's just a mistake here? I mean, that's what you're really arguing, is that the agency made a mistake, because we don't have to guess at what it intended to do, because it's crystal clear in stating what it intended to do. It just made a mistake in how it actually implemented that.
That's correct. It is clear what they claim they intended to do. I'd say 90% clear. Mm-hmm. But it's also clear that the text of the regulation itself doesn't support their interpretation. The part of the regulation that they changed was in subsection A, where they added this definition of predicate facts. The part of the regulation that is at issue, the three-year reopening, is in subsection B, and it only applies to reopenings made upon request. That's none of the hospitals in this case requested a reopening. So just on its face, it doesn't apply to our case. They had the opportunity in the rule, and the Secretary noted that we considered amending 405-1835, which is what governs statutory appeals, but we basically decided at this time not to do so. We don't know why they decided not to do so, but it would have made it very clear.
In what sense, this is a question, I suppose, for the government as well, but what sense would it make not to have it apply to one and not the other?
Well, they're completely separate procedural mechanisms to appeal cost report determinations.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying, if you wanted to preclude challenges to predicate facts, what sense would it make to allow predicate facts to be challenged in appeals but not in reopenings, do you think?
All I can state is, again, they're different. The reopening regulation is completely permissive. It's not a creature of statute. It's a creature that the Secretary created, whereas the statutory appeals that we proceeded under 1395-00 are quite clear that with very few restrictions other than the amount in controversy and that you have to bring it within 180 days, the provider is virtually unrestricted about what he can appeal under 1835. So why the Secretary didn't amend that regulation at the same time, I don't know. But the Kaiser case and then the long line of precedent, the Supreme Court Bowles line of precedent, we believe is clear that deference is not warranted when the Secretary's interpretation is contrary to the text of the statute.
What about all the references to appeals that are included in the regulation? In the reopening section, what about the reference to appeal?
In the text of the regulation itself?
Yes. Romanet 3, I love that word, Romanet. Romanet 3, a specific finding on a matter at issue may include a predicate fact. And then in parentheses, in an appeal filed. And then in Romanet 4, it says the three-year... And then in, let's see, I can't even tell what this is. Looks like C3, reopening by CMS or contractor currently on appeal to the board. CMS or contractor may reopen. Secretary determination that it's currently pending on appeal.
The section, as I mentioned earlier, the section that the Secretary amended in the appeal was subsection A, which you were just reading from.
Yes.
The subsection that provides the three-year limit is on subsection B, however, and it's very clear that subsection B only applies to reopenings made upon request.
What is the parentheses in appeal filed?
Your Honor, I don't know what the Secretary intended with that. That is a new part of the regulation.
Yes.
It could mean the predicate fact was determined at a prior point in time as a result of an appeal. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what the Secretary meant.
So you're telling me it's ambiguous?
I think that is ambiguous. I do think that's ambiguous. But so, in any event, yeah. It's only ambiguity relates to subsection A. It has no applicability to subsection B, which is the three-year limit.
Well, but doesn't subsection B relate back? Once you've amended the definition of or changed what a specific finding on a predicate fact, that applies to the rest of the...
It does, but subsection B is the one that applies only to, quote, a reopening made upon request. It doesn't say a reopening made upon request or appeals under 1835. It's only reopenings. That's all that regulation applies to. And the Secretary made a mistake, to echo Judge Kavanaugh, in attempting to apply the regulation to these hospitals, but didn't properly do so. Even though he said in the preamble, this is what I want to do, I'm going to apply it to all pending appeals, he didn't have the authority to do that by virtue of 1885. If I could proceed, Your Honor, secondly, even assuming that this regulation does apply to these hospitals, we strongly urge that it doesn't, as applied, it's arbitrary and capricious and inconsistent with the Medicare statute.
Their big argument on that, as you're well aware, is finality, and maybe burden is a better word in my view for that, stale records, things like that. So exactly how would the agency proceed, do you suspect or do you propose, if you were to prevail on this claim?
Your Honor, that's something that the Secretary is going to have to determine. There could be a number of ways. The Secretary correctly...
But I think the reason I'm asking is because they say it's nigh impossible, and I think they're tossing it back to you to say, no, actually it is possible. Here's how you would do it, and I'm interested in
your answer. Right. They stated that in their pleadings or in their briefs that it's not part of the record below. We don't actually have any evidence of what the Secretary, what data the Secretary does or doesn't have. We just
so
have
part of your argument is that at a minimum, it should go back, at a minimum, for them to explain the staleness burden argument.
I wouldn't ask them to explain the staleness or burden. If the court remands it, I think the remand would be to instruct the Secretary to recalculate the standardized amount.
There's a lesser included way to argument there too, which is on this record it's substantively unreasonable or arbitrary and capricious, you would say, and maybe they have some argument they can use to justify it, but they haven't articulated it here. That's you can go for the whole loaf. You don't have to go for a half a loaf.
No. When they I'm not meaning to be coy either. I can't really fix that problem for the government. What I can say is that a few years later, 7 years later, they corrected this problem with the capital cost prospective payment system.
The problem seems to be a pretty pervasive one, which is it's really hard in the 2017s to go back and figure out what's happening in hospitals in 1981 or 1983 or 1984. And that's going to be true regardless of whether the issue is discharge or transfer or any other of the dozens, if not hundreds, of determinations that could go into a predicate fact establishment.
Thank you. Right? That raises the issue of finality versus accuracy. The government is trumping finality over anything else. But to respond to your question, it's unreasonable. Yes, it may be difficult to try to figure out the correct data or to figure out a proxy for that. It's not something that I can do on the back of an envelope, but it's even worse for these hospitals to continue forever to be underpaid under the standardized amount because that error is not correct.
How could anyone do this? And the government's statement when this issue first came up in the early 80s was that we can't really do this because the data at the time don't distinguish discharges from transfers, and they couldn't unscramble that in the early 80s. How in the world are they going to do it 35 years later?
That's not what the government said in 1984, Your Honor. What the government said was that no data has been submitted or collected, I don't remember the operative word, to indicate the difference or the magnitude of the difference between transfers and discharges. An important point is that the secretary was the one doing the collecting. It wasn't up to the provider community to submit something because the secretary didn't even raise this issue until the final rule after the comment period had long expired. And what the secretary said was he acknowledged there was an error. He called it a discrepancy. So he acknowledged the error. It wasn't that we can't determine if there was an error. He acknowledged that transfers were counted as part of the discharge count and shouldn't be under PPS. But he simply said that the magnitude of the change, it's not significant. We don't think it's material. And in fact, it's quite material. So he made a decision, what the government calls in their brief, a judgment call, and claims that judgment call was an appropriate one. In fact, the judgment call was just to ignore the error.
Suppose we knew that there's no way to perfectly reconstruct which discharges were transfers, but that you could try to make a reason, the government could try to make a reasonable estimate. And the government says, well, we don't want to do a reasonable estimate. We can't go back and recalculate it exactly, so we're not going to recalculate it at all as a matter of finality and burden. What would you say in response to that?
I think that would be unreasonable, not a permissible construction of the statute. We would get to that point if the court agreed that they had underpaid and that the standardized amount had been improperly calculated under 1395 WW. And so if that statute was not followed, then the statute was violated. And for the secretary to violate the statute and then years later to say, well, you know what, we can't figure out quite how to fix that, and so we're not going to fix it unless we can do it perfectly, that wouldn't be a reasonable response, Your Honor.
Can I, just to pick up on Judge Katz's point, don't we have sort of a res ipsa locator issue here? We're now in 2018. And we're 2018, and we're looking back to facts that occurred in the early 80s, and not only with respect to this, but with respect to all the other predicate facts that Judge Katsas was talking about. If there's a burden, why isn't the burden on challengers to say that, oh no, it doesn't matter, that many years have passed, but the data is still somewhere? Why isn't that alone sufficient to make the agency's judgment that it will be difficult and maybe impossible to correct the record at this late date?
Well, it's to accept that argument would be in essence to reward the government for the original error.
Well, that's a different question. I want to start with the first question, which is the government is not unreasonable in saying that from the viewpoint of this year, it's going to be hard, if not impossible, to correct something that occurred in the 80s. I mean, different computer systems, maybe they didn't have computers. I don't know how they listed that, wrote these things down in those days. That's not I get your balancing issue, but that issue is not unreasonable, is it?
The observation that this was a long time ago and that this data is difficult to collect and collate and make some sense of is not an unreasonable observation, I agree.
So now we get to the other side of the question, which is it's not fair, it's not reasonable to be stuck with an error. But that's true of every kind of statute of limitations. If the bank robber is not caught in 7 years, he gets to keep his money, and it's terrible. If somebody who assaults somebody is not caught in a certain number of years, you know, it's terrible, it happens, but it's bad. Leave aside the criminal cases and all the civil cases. There are statutes of limitations. Somebody cheated somebody out of something. Very bad, but we don't go back and correct the record. Homicide is about the only circumstance. Mm-hmm. And terrorism, where we actually go back and say, we don't care about the passage of time, we're going to correct this anyway. So this is a kind of balancing that the law, both the common law and the statutory law, does all the time. Why is this any different than that?
This case, Your Honor, I submit is different because examples that the court just gave are of single acts, homicide, some sort of event that occurred at one point in time, and there's a statute of limitations that expires before that event can be challenged or corrected. This event, the improper calculation of the standardized amount in 1984, recurs each and every year. Every time the Secretary publishes the new inpatient prospective payment system final rule, that error is embedded in that rule. Every time the hospitals admit a Medicare patient and get paid for it, they're getting paid a fraction less than they should have been paid had that been properly determined in 1984.
To go back to Chief Judge Garland's prior question, could this be done?
Could the correction be done?
Yeah.
Yes, I think it absolutely could
and
be,
how?
Your Honor.
I mean, I started with this question, but I'm still searching for how.
So one, I offered one suggestion of however the Secretary made the calculation for capital cost PPS just a few years later. They made an adjustment to remove transfers from the discharge count. Mm-hmm. I think it was, you know, about a 1% number. I don't quote me on that. The Secretary all the time in the Medicare program, it's a very complex program, the Secretary uses proxies and extrapolations and estimates all the time. Not everything in the Medicare program is an absolutely perfectly principled calculation. So the Secretary is very accustomed to making judgment calls. The judgment call that he made in 1984 was just, you know what, it's not significant, so we're not going to do anything about it. And we submit that he could have made a judgment call and should have made a judgment call to make some assessment of that error.
Does that seem like an unreasonable judgment? I mean, just intuitively, you would think most people who leave Hospital A leave it to go home rather than to be transferred to Hospital B.
Right.
Doesn't that seem to accord with common sense?
Well, if I understand Your Honor's question, the PPS statute was quite clear to treat discharges and transfers separately.
Oh, but the Secretary's judgment that it's a relatively small error doesn't seem obviously wrong to me on this particular question.
Yeah,
it's hundreds
of millions of dollars, Your Honor, and the judgment call that the Secretary made at the time was to acknowledge the error. He called it a discrepancy, but he acknowledged we did not adjust for transfers. But he simply minimized it, said it doesn't have a significant effect. 7 years later, he realized it actually did have a significant effect.
Because it might have appeared small. Might have appeared small at the time, but now with
the passage of time,
passage
it's quite
of time,
obvious.
See, no, actually, this is hundreds of millions of dollars.
That's because of the compounding effect?
Just that
you're off by 5% for 30 years.
There isn't actually any real compounding, I don't think, mathematically, but it's simply that costs are more expensive today than they were then.
Why did you not challenge this earlier?
Your Honor, the Secretary himself raised the issue in the final rule after PPS had actually already started.
That's not what I mean. I mean, the question of why didn't you challenge...
Why these plaintiffs?
Why the plaintiffs didn't challenge the erroneous base year many years before, and for cost years many years before.
I was giving background to get to your answer. No, that's all right.
I apologize.
In 1984, the Secretary himself raised the issue at the time of the publication of the final rule. There was no opportunity for anyone to comment. The provider community didn't really understand this issue at the time. I think, frankly, our clients in the early 2003-2004, the decision makers at our clients began to be aware of this issue, and that was the time they initiated their appeals to the board.
You have, 75 different hospitals?
277.
Okay. So How many of them, if any, were getting reimbursements under this scheme? At what time frame? Was there anyone who was around in the early 80s who could have challenged that rule?
I don't know the answer. I'm sure some of them were, Your Honor.
Can I ask, I thought that this was just a stark, unitary legal question, which is either the regulation means what the government says, in which case nobody can ever go back and challenge a predicate fact, or it means what you say, and the question is wide open in any appeal for any predicate fact. Did I understand you towards the beginning of the argument to suggest a different possibility, which is maybe some predicate facts can be challenged and others not, and there's an arbitrary and capricious review based on how obvious particular errors are or how hard particular calculations are? I would have thought it's either one or the other.
What's arbitrary and capricious, one of the things, is to allow an embedded error into the system that has no opportunity for correction. It replicates itself each and every year.
But it seems like your legal theory would enable challenges regardless of whether the error was small or large, and regardless of whether the error was obvious or subtle.
That's right. That's because 1395-00, which is the operative statutory provision governing all Medicare appeals, is virtually unrestricted, other than the 180-day requirement and the $10,000 amount in controversy requirement. There are no restrictions in that statute as to the topic that can be, it can be any matter covered by a cost report. The standardized amount is baked into both the Secretary's final rule and the individual cost reports of each provider each year.
I understood you to be saying that it's unreasonable to enshrine false predicate facts into the formula going forward.
Correct.
But it's going to be different in different kinds of predicate fact cases to go back and try to challenge them as being wrong. In this case, you would be able to, you say, show that the transfer discharge number is wrong, and you have some support for that given what the Secretary did in other contexts. To pick up on Judge Katz's question, in other contexts, though, you may not be able to go back and really recreate things to show that it was wrong in the first place, right?
I can't speculate whether there might be
your points about this predicate fact, the regulation is unreasonable, but as applied to this predicate fact, we know it's wrong, and you say, and this is a hard part of the case for me, but you say it can be corrected, and therefore it's unreasonable not to correct it.
This predicate fact amendment, the 2013 amendment, by definition only applies to predicate facts that have extended or permanent implications for the future. It doesn't apply to facts that are year-to-year sorts of facts. The Secretary was careful to limit it that way. So by definition, what he's doing is not just for us, but for any hospital that wants to challenge an incorrect predicate fact that has ongoing reimbursement consequences, they're out of luck if they didn't do it within the statutory time period.
I guess my point is it's going to be hard to show incorrectness for some that are really old and there are no records. But here, you're saying we can easily show incorrectness because they've admitted incorrectness in the other as to the transfer discharge number.
We may not
know the precise amount of the incorrectness, right, but we know there's incorrectness.
That's correct, and I'm certainly not trying to make an argument for any other plaintiffs out there, but our point is a broader one indeed than just this case. We are saying that it's unreasonable for the Secretary to adopt a regulation that has no statutory underpinning itself that completely eliminates challenges to reimbursement formulas that have, by definition, ongoing reimbursement effect.
But you agree that in the context of any particular challenge, it would be the hospital's burden to show error?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Can I ask you, when you were distinguishing my examples of statute of limitations, your argument was that none of them None of those cases preserve ongoing effect of past actions, right?
Essentially, yes.
So in the Ledbetter case, the Supreme Court held that each new discriminatory pay is a separate item subject to the statute of limitations, notwithstanding the fact that it could be affected by discrimination that occurred outside of the time period, and so that you were not allowed to make an argument that discrimination outside the time period affected the future ones, and therefore go back and correct that. Why isn't that the same? And maybe even worse, because we're talking about sex and race discrimination in that circumstance, rather than just lack of payment for medical costs.
I'm not familiar with the Ledbetter case, Your Honor, but I would just emphasize that the nature of the Medicare reimbursement system is such that, and particularly in the prospective payment system part of it, that each year is a new year for that hospital. And so using other examples that the court's aware of, for example, GME or the caps on the number of residents, there's a formula that's baked in from a base year, and that has implications in the future. So each and every year in the future, that formula is going to impact the reimbursement that year. It's a brand new reimbursement.
Right.
For us, it's
the same thing is true for a woman who current pay is lower than the men's because of discrimination that occurred 5 years ago, 8 years ago, and yet she can't complain under the Ledbetter. Now, Congress overruled that by statute, but the Supreme Court, in reading the that statute, said that she can't complain about those past acts. Those are past acts, even though they affect the present. And here the agency is saying this happened a very long time ago. It could have been corrected sometime in the interim. You could have done it within 3 years. Actually, you could have done it all the way, you know, before they passed this new regulation. And that would have corrected forever for the prospective. Mm-hmm. But you didn't. That is bad. But on balance, our system puts a high value on repose. And that's what they've done here because of the problems that Judge Katsas was talking about, the difficulties of going back that far. Mm-hmm. So my only question is, why isn't that, I know it's not the one you want, but the question is, why isn't that reasonable? How can it be unreasonable to put so much value on a value, repose, that our system obviously puts high, even sometimes higher than race or sex discrimination?
And not to minimize the importance of that issue, and I'm not familiar with that case, but my reply, this court in the Cape Cod case stated affirmatively that it's not a reasonable or permissible construction of the Medicare statute to embed errors indefinitely into the future. That's what we're relying on, Your Honor.
And if Congress passed a statute doing so, then it'd be like the Ledbetter case.
If Congress passed a statute
that said you couldn't
absolutely
challenge the predicate facts after. The question here is the exercise of agency discretion, not reading a statute that precludes the challenge. And the question then is whether it's reasonable. And Chief Judge Garland raises a good point. The law often puts a period of repose or says that certain old facts can't be challenged. The question here is whether it's reasonable and what the agency's reasons are.
Yeah. And to respond to that, Your Honor, the agency has argued this same issue the other way multiple times, the Regents case, the Health East case that we cite in our briefs. So the holding finality up as sort of a talisman that nothing else can surmount that is not reasonable, that, and Cape Cod was quite clear that you can't do that if it's going to simply lock in permanent errors into the system. These are not one-off claims. They're claims that reassert themselves each and every year, and we believe that the Secretary inappropriately calculated the standardized amount originally and failed to, even though he disagreed with the Kaiser case, failed to publish a regulation that applies to our hospitals who didn't ask to reopen any of their cost reports. And even though I didn't have a chance to get to this in the argument, the Secretary clearly didn't satisfy the twin statutory formulas for applying the rule retroactively.
Can I ask one question on that, this on the retroactivity and what you regard as retroactive? Is the only thing that you're regarding as retroactive here the application to pending cases, or is it also retroactive for a regulation issued in 2013 to affect a cost year, which is already finished, even though the hospital hasn't yet filed its request for reimbursement? So I'm just, this is, as a hypothetical, the issue in 2013, there's the cost year of 2012, the hospital hasn't yet filed for whatever reason, and the 2013 rule is now going to affect its ability to recover from 2012. Is that also retroactive in your view?
No, if I can restate it, I would argue that a cost reporting period that has been completed but has not been appealed in any kind of way by the provider, the 2013 amendment could apply to that. That would not have a retroactive effect to those providers. It's the fact that we had already filed our appeals years before.
So it's only because of the fact that you filed your appeals?
Correct.
So I was just wondering, I'm not asking you to expand your claim, but I'm just wondering about that. It does mean that if it applies with respect to the way in which we had decided Kaiser, that you now won't be able to get the money that you would have otherwise been able to get it for a year that's already passed. That is the consequence of a rule from 2013 that applies to cost years where there hasn't even been an appeal.
And that's the nature of the appeal process and the cost reporting process.
But you don't regard that as retroactive. That's a prospective issue.
That's correct. Okay, but we obviously argue that the rule is impermissibly,
no, I understand.
Can't be applied prospectively.
All right. We'll hear from the other side.
May it please the Court, Melissa Patterson for the Secretary. I think it'd be helpful to start with the idea of repose. The Secretary here has instituted a regulation that says many years after an error was made, you can't go back and ask us to change that error. At some point, there is a limitations period.
They're not trying to reopen cost reports. Correct. They're not trying to reopen closed cost reports.
Not in that sense, Director, but they are trying to reopen a determination made many, many cost reports ago.
But isn't it, I would have thought, the definition of arbitrary and capricious is for the government to come in and say, we are going to knowingly use a false fact in perpetuity to calculate how much money you're owed. That would seem inherently unreasonable unless the government could say it's not false, or there's no way for us to figure out whether it's false.
I think we're getting close to the merits here. Just as an initial matter, I want to make clear, the board did not actually engage with the merits of the claim under WWD2A.
I understand, but why isn't it inherently arbitrary and capricious for the government to come and say, we are going to bar challenges to predicate facts, thereby permanently enshrining in a formula that has hundreds of millions of dollars in effects a false fact that could be corrected, and that could be corrected is key as applied to particular cases. But even if it could be corrected, the government's saying, forget about it. We made a mistake once, so in perpetuity.
I don't think that's quite the setup here, Your Honor. Suppose that the government, as you seem to be positing, and I think as appellant said, proclaimed in 1983, we have made an error, and yet we are baking that into the formula. Everyone who was a provider then would have had ample notice.
What about providers who weren't around then? Do they have a separate rule then? If they weren't around then, you can challenge it?
No, Your Honor, but I think the idea that if you come into the system after a number has sort of been hardwired into the formula, and remember, this is part of a system designed to peg all future reimbursements to a determination made in 1983, I think it's hard for you to say, I wasn't on notice about what that variable in the formula would be, that I thought I would have a chance to turn that constant into a variable.
I'm not talking retroactivity. You're on notice. You just think it's wrong. It's wrong for me to be forced to pay receive millions of dollars less because of something that we all know is a mistake and that could be corrected. That just...
Your Honor, I do want to push back on the all know that this is a mistake. Again, the merits have not been addressed. The government very much thinks...
But you would, even if we all do know it's a mistake, you're going to say the same rule applies, correct?
I am, Your Honor, because we think that there is consistent with the idea of repose. You have 3 years...
So saying that the merits haven't been decided is really a little bit misleading, right? Because on your view, the merits never will be decided.
That's right, Your Honor. I think that I don't want to leave any impression that we concede that there was some sort of problem with the way we implemented the 1983 prospective payment system with the calculations we did back in 1983. My point to Judge Kavanaugh is that if this court were to decide that the regulation did not bar these appeals for whatever reason, the proper course would be to remand the agency for further proceedings such that the agency could then engage with that. Again, we would defend our implementation of D2A.
But we said in Kaiser that the Supreme Court and Regents had the Secretary had recognized the absurdity of allowing a mistake in a base year calculation to be perpetuated indefinitely due to the time limit on reopening.
I think that if you read Regions, Your Honor, there actually is a different lesson to be taken. In Regions, recall...
I've read it.
The providers were the ones saying, no, these years are closed. You cannot go back and reopen. You can't re-audit the data. If there's errors, those errors are baked in. And there, in an exercise of discretion, the Secretary enacted a targeted regulation that departed from what we consider to be the background rule that after 3 years, those determinations are closed. But even with an only five-year gap, in Regions, it was a matter of 1984 data that was subject to a 1989 re-auditing regulation. The Supreme Court specifically noted the validity of concerns about fading memories, about lost documentation, and it went through an analysis to decide whether or not the regulation, the re-auditing regulation the Secretary had put forth, was reasonable despite that concern about stale evidence.
The Secretary was the one there arguing that's not a, should not be a concern.
Yes, and we had to justify why in that particular context. And remember,
this is my concern about the rule, is that it bars any examination of something that could be easily corrected. And then you would push back on the merits if we went back to the Secretary, and this is what I was getting at with my questions. Justify yourself. Could this be corrected, or it can't? It really can't be corrected. Now, you have some boilerplate language about staleness and records, but I don't know if that's true or not. It's not explained in any way. Maybe it is true, maybe it's not, but as to the facts here, it seems questionable because of the correction to the discharge transfer figure that was done in the other part of the system. So, but you would say it doesn't matter. Even if we knew that it was wrong, and even if it was easily corrected, and even if for a particular predicate fact, we had it right here, we could do it in 10 minutes and correct it, and it would be hundreds of million dollars, you would still say that can't be challenged, and that's perfectly reasonable?
Yes, and let me explain why, Your Honor. If it were really so evident that there was some sort of error, if we had said, this is wrong and we're going to use it anyway, we have tens of thousands of providers out there who have not only a 180-day to appeal, and recall that in both Region Arbor, Auburn Regional and your home, the Supreme Court specifically said these are sophisticated providers who are fully capable of with 180-day finding errors.
What if the error only became apparent later is question one variation, and what if it's a provider that wasn't around at the time able to protect its right?
And here's the second part of my answer, Your Honor, which is that the prospective payment system is designed to promote predictability. You're supposed to take a number, an unchanging number, and carry it forward every year. I want to note that this is not...
But Congress didn't say that. Congress did not say that. Congress said, look at the discharges, and that Secretary erred by counting transfers as discharges. Congress didn't say, freeze false facts indefinitely.
And then Congress said, take that standardized amount calculation that results from the aggregated allowable costs per discharge and carry it forward every year, update it only for inflation. And I want to note that this is a two-way street, Your Honor. We have bound ourselves. If we find an error and we say, oh, gosh, we have been overpaying people, the new regulation ties our hands from going back and clawing back amounts paid previously.
Do you think it helps to say that the government is binding itself to throwing away hundreds of millions of dollars of its own we made a mistake in the formula? I mean, I just think that compounds the problem here.
Your Honor, I think that it shows that the Secretary is serious.
I think it shows they're even-handed, but yeah.
Or even-handed in saying that there is real value in repose and predictability in this scheme. If we have the standardized amount that undergirds every single inpatient prospective payment system payment across decades and tens of thousands of providers changing year to year. Remember, the theory here is that every time it gets carried forward, that restarts your clock to challenge it. So suppose these providers were to succeed on this appeal, and suppose they got a remand, and suppose the board said, yeah, we're going to change the standardized amount.
What's the sky is falling if that happens?
That would mean that every other provider who thinks that they have come up with a new data set that's been in a closet since 1981 could also force a change. That means in the standardized amount, such that we would have an ever-shifting standardized amount. It also means that the government...
Do you really think those would be successful? The reason this comes up is because we know it's wrong.
I disagree, Your Honor. We do not know it's wrong. And that, again, is a merits matter that has not been determined yet.
But even if we know it's wrong, it's not going to be able to be corrected.
Even if we know it's wrong, it's been hardwired into the formula for 30 years at this point. And I think it is notable that Congress is certainly not inattentive to the Medicare statute and not inattentive to prospective payment system payments here, repeatedly against the backdrop of a static standardized amount. Congress has tinkered with this program. I think it would come as quite a surprise that now the Secretary is
Did Congress freak out when Kaiser came down?
They did not, but of course there were no immediate consequences.
No,
because,
they didn't. They didn't.
Kaiser did not purport to Kaiser addressed only the regulatory language as it existed at the time. There was no statutory analysis. It left the Secretary free, as the Secretary then chose to do, to engage in a new rulemaking that made clear that in the Secretary's view, these types of challenges are not evergreen. You get 3 years to challenge them, and then at that point, everybody, the government can't change them, providers can't change them, it's a fixed constant.
If we accept your friend's concession that it's the burden will always lie on the challengers to show error, why doesn't the difficulty of showing error of facts that happened 35 years ago, why doesn't that just underscore the narrowness of this and answer your finality and repose concerns to the extent that lots of challengers can bring challenges and almost all of them will fail because they can't meet their burden of showing error 35 years ago?
Well, first, Your Honor, I think that would entail a quite high level of administrative burden. And the Supreme Court in Auburn Regional said, listen, when the Secretary is interpreting statutes here, we need to pay attention to her expertise in running this massive program. When she said that the appeal deadline was subject to no more than a three-year good cause, and this court, I think, had said it was subject to equitable tolling, the Supreme Court said, we are going to defer to the Secretary's interpretation of this very provision of the appeal right at 1395.00. I think it's important to recollect that that is the statute on which they are hinging the idea that their appeal rights are somehow being truncated contrary to a statute. That statute does not say you get to challenge an error however long ago it was made. That statute says you may appeal an intermediary's decision with respect to a cost report. And in a very real sense, these are not errors within a cost report, which is a one-year period, subject to a 180-day appeal challenge. It is somewhat startling to say that by enacting that scheme, Congress thought you essentially were going to have an unlimited opportunity to challenge that.
Well, since you bring up the appeal statute, let's go back to the first issue in the case, which is whether the regulation even covers appeals.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your brief does a very effective job of eliding the preamble, which is very helpful for you, with the actual text, the regulation, which is not so helpful to you. I have to say, I just don't see how this regulation in the context of this scheme can be read to cover appeals. And appeals and reopenings are very different schemes, and the reopening regulation recognizes that.
Your Honor, I'm happy to walk through the text of the statute or the regulation, but I think it is helpful to note, and this goes to a question that Chief Judge Garland asked, is that the preamble here, it is part of the very rulemaking. It was done through notice and comment.
But it doesn't have the force and effect of law. You still need an argument why the position in the preamble is at least a minimally reasonable reading of the regulation.
You do, and so I think that the only argument they have is that our interpretation of the statute is flatly inconsistent with the plain language. I also want to note, I know that there is
he's talking about the regulation.
That's what you meant, I think.
I did mean the regulation. I apologize, Your Honor. The concern, I know the law of the circuit under Grossmont Hospital is that you defer to reasonable interpretations of the Secretary's interpretations of the regulations. I think that the concerns that often arise with that regime are when an agency is trying to post hoc narrow.
Yeah, I understand. And I mean, we can talk about whether to adjust the level of our deference depending on whether it's a preamble or a 10 years later a sub-regulatory document. I get that. But you still have to have some textual basis for extending this regulation from reopenings to appeals.
So I think
the statutory and regulatory structure seems crystal clear that an appeal is one kind of thing and a reopening is another kind of thing. Appeals go from one decision maker to another. They are statutory. They have their own limitations period. I mean, they are just different.
But they have always been understood to intersect. And this court's analysis in Kaiser, I think, sets the backdrop here. The court, if it had been so clear that the reopening regulation just didn't intersect with your appeal rights, recall that the challenges there were also brought through the appeal mechanism. But the court didn't say, why are we talking about this reopening regulation?
And when the government lost Kaiser. Kaiser was all about the old appeal regulation, but when the government lost Kaiser, the upshot was that providers could take appeals through the separate appeal mechanism.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if you misspoke there. Kaiser was all about the old reopening
regulation. I'm
sorry,
It
was, and so the Secretary explained that she was changing. The problem Kaiser identified was not that somehow reopening regulations had no intersection with the appeal, that somehow you could be in your appeal time but outside your reopening window. The problem was that the regulation then did not encompass predicate facts, this court found. And so what did we do? We went back and we added a definition that said a specific
A definition of predicate facts which operates to narrow the 3-year statute of limitations that applies to reopenings, not to be confused with the separate statutory, I think it's 180-day statute of limitations for statutory appeals.
So here's where it might be helpful to turn to the text.
Sure.
And I'm looking at subsection A, 1, Romanet 3.
You're in 1885?
I am, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. 3, right, which is, as far as I can tell, the only textual reference to appeals in the amendment, correct?
I believe that is correct, but I think it has to be read, and if you put the pieces together, so in Romanet 3, it says, I'm looking at the parenthetical,
right,
in an appeal filed or a reopening requested,
right.
And what that modifies is the period at issue. If what you are complaining about in the period at issue, in the cost report that's still open, whether through an appeal or through a reopening is a predicate fact, it is subject to the time limitations in subsection B.
This is the definition of predicate facts, right?
Yes.
It says the predicate fact can be determined in an adjudication that happened, is a determination through an adjudication that happened some time ago, right? There's a question, the question arises about the 1984 data, and it is initially determined, let's say, in an adjudication in 1985, 1986, whatever. This parenthetical tells you that can be determined in a 1985 reopening or a 1985 appeal.
I don't think that
makes it a predicate fact. That's all that does.
I think that the in an appeal filed or a reopening requested modifies the period at issue, and the period at issue is the period at issue in a reopening request. Recall that subsection B24 makes clear that you calculate the three-year limit for each predicate fact separately. So read together, I think these provisions mean when what you are complaining about, when the period at issue that you are complaining about, whether through an appeal or through a reopening, is a predicate fact, you calculate the limitations period by virtue of subsection B24 separately.
The period at issue here is something approximate to the present, right? It's 15 or 16 or 17, right?
I believe it's
the cost report.
2002 through 2015, Your Honor.
Okay, so yes. The cost report for which they're seeking compensation.
Yes.
Right? And the predicate fact is something
that was determined before that.
So for correct. Discharges and transfers, presumably now we're back to the early 80s for that.
Yes.
And I don't see what this does other than tell you that the initial determination here in the early 80s can happen through an appeal or a reopening. I don't see how that impacts the question here whether a statute of limitations that on its face addresses reopening should be extended to the separate scheme for appeals.
Well, Your Honor, we may just be reading the parenthetical differently. I think properly read, and certainly as the Secretary unambiguously expressed in the preamble, is that it is supposed to cut off challenges to a predicate fact unless they are through a timely appeal of the first cost period when they arose or were determined or applied in this particular way. And so I to the extent that this regulation is ambiguous, and I do want to note that Judge Bates determined that properly read as a whole, this regime was unambiguous.
He was counting the preamble on that.
I think that he did a preamble, and we think properly took it into account. I think in the next paragraph, he then goes on to say, in any event, plaintiffs are simply understanding how these provisions intersect. And again, against the backdrop of Kaiser, where the problem was, your regulation just doesn't even apply to predicate facts. It is very clear what the Secretary was trying to accomplish by adding.
Why is it so messy, then, to pick up on Judge Katz's point? This is an easily understood situation where the language could have been clearly articulated in the regulation, but it's not. What happened?
Your Honor, I think agencies can always be clearer. I do think it's helpful to remember
that's
two
true.
Facts.
That's always true, and that's true of judges, too, but this is particularly botched. We shouldn't be having this argument if Kaiser was the backdrop and given the preamble.
Your Honor, I think two facts are important to remember. One, while this certainly does cover the particular scenario at issue in Kaiser, this regulation covers huge swaths of activities. It's not only intermediary determinations, it's secretary determinations, it's board determinations. So the idea that the phrasing may be not entirely pellucid as applied to this situation, I don't think should surprise anyone when the secretary is having to regulate across such a wide spectrum of different types of decisions. And second, this was put out, I think, several months after the Kaiser decision was issued. The notice of proposed rulemaking, I think, came out in July of that year, I think 3 or 4 months after the Kaiser decision. So I think it would be a little unfair to say, well, we know exactly what you were trying to do, agency, and maybe there's a way that you can read the references to appeal here to get there, but we're just not going to believe you when you said and when you committed yourself. Recall that this is an interpretation of the statute promulgated through notice and comment rulemaking. The agency thinks if it's going to deviate from this rule by which it has bound itself and binds providers, I think it would have to go through notice and comment rulemaking again. I don't think it could come in with a sub-notice and comment rulemaking interpretation to kind of yank the rug out from people here. So in this instance, I think it would be very strange to say, well, we just don't know what the secretary means. The secretary didn't mean it to apply appeals. As the district court found, it is crystal clear that the secretary was trying to get at both appeals and reopenings through this change.
To me, the parenthetical actually hurts your case because it underscores what other parts of 1885 confirm, which is that appeals and reopenings are different.
Yes, Your Honor, but by referring to appeals, if the period at issue that you are complaining about, whether through an appeal or through a reopening, is about a predicate fact, the time starts for that predicate fact as of the date it was issued.
If that were true, then the government should have won Kaiser on the alternative ground that even apart from the terms of the old 1885 regulation, the appeal isn't challenging the reported issue because to the extent it's trying to go back and determine a predicate fact, which you say is not really in the cost report.
Your Honor, I don't think any of that language was in the regulation at the time. Recall that we thought it already said that. We thought that the finding on a matter at issue already encompassed, already swept in predicate facts.
No, but the statute, the statute for appeals to the PRRB talks about the period covered by the report. And your answer to their argument why the regulation is inconsistent with the statute is to say, well, period covered by the report just means the cost period insofar as it challenges newly arising factual questions.
Well, Your Honor,
if you're using a 2015 cost report to re-adjudicate a 1984 predicate fact, you say, well, it's not really a 2015 cost report at that point.
Well, Your Honor, we're looking at slightly different phrasings in the statute, and I don't think that the Secretary, in referring to the period at issue in Romanet 3, necessarily was hearkening back to the with respect to such cost report. I certainly think that is a permissible or reflects a permissible understanding of the appeal statute, that the appeal statute does not give you an unfettered right, an unfettered clock that restarts every year in the prospective payment system. But I don't think the Secretary, by using these somewhat different words to refer to the period at issue, was importing the same definition of 1395-00. I do want to make the point that the district court did not consider the appeal right in 1395-00, and that is because it was not actually challenged at that point.
I understand that, and I agree with your waiver point, and they don't have a freestanding statutory argument in the appeal, but I also think that the structure of that statute, which defines appeals, PRRB appeals, as a creature wholly separate from reopenings, has some bearing on how we read the reopening reg.
It may have some bearing on it, Your Honor, but I think, again, filtered through the preamble, which is the Secretary's definitive interpretation that this language should not be interpreted to allow appeals to go forward when that clearly was not the Secretary's intent. And I do want to note, if the court thinks that this language didn't do what the Secretary thought it did, the appropriate thing to do would be to remand to the agency for further proceedings, and it is possible the Secretary would have another crack at it at that point, since we know exactly what the Secretary wanted to do and the reasons that the Secretary thought that was the best way to run the Medicare reimbursement appeal challenge.
We usually remand for explanation. We don't remand for fixing the regulation.
You could also remand for, I think that if it took the course it did in Kaiser, the court simply said remand for further agency proceedings. If you were to determine that this regulation did not apply to appeals on its face, you would remand. The board would presumably restart the appeal process that was halted when it decided it lacked jurisdiction under this appeal. But as in Kaiser, I think that would leave the Secretary free to use her discretion and to put out a regulation that perhaps more clearly did what she thought it did.
You're talking about what the district court said in Kaiser?
I believe that this court affirmed the district court's remand for further agency proceedings in Kunzer.
It just says affirmed, but...
I think earlier in the decision it says that the district court remanded for further agency proceedings, mm-hmm. and that would be the appropriate remedy here as well.
I have two questions. Are there hospitals that might have relied on the allocation as it was to make determinations of what kind of patients to admit or not admit, what kind of costs to spend or not spend, and that might be now at a disadvantage for having made those business decisions if we were to go the way that the petitioners want?
I think that is a risk, Your Honor, especially because the plaintiff's theory here would open it up to the secretary to also start deciding that there were errors or inaccuracies in the standardized amount. And so to the extent that their position is the statute requires anyone to be able to make these sorts of changes, I think it very much would hurt hospitals and the Medicare system who are trying to project their cost into the future.
How?
I think, well, there are a lot of different variables in these formulas, Your Honor, but one thing has always been understood to be fixed, and that is the baseline. Here it's a standardized amount, but these sorts of baseline where Congress says take a certain year and then inflate from there, those have been understood to be unchanging. They're supposed to be unchanging. And so I think if we all got into the business of tinkering with those numbers, you would be undermining to some extent.
More accurate.
You would be undermining to some extent the predictability that Congress intended this system to bring.
When we say more accurate, we mean in 1982, or whatever the year was. Is that right?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, when Judge Kavanaugh says, or when the petitioners argue that base year was inaccurate, that was a long time ago with respect to what the number, even if they are completely correct, even if petitioners are completely correct, the allocation between discharges and transfers was whatever it was in that year, right?
Yes, I think that's
right.
It's
not what it is in this year. It's not what it was any time in the 20 years after that.
That's correct.
It's just a number.
It is just a number.
It could have been a number not based on transfers and allocations.
Yeah, Congress could have said $10.
That's what Congress chose, though.
Well, it did.
That may be Congress's mistake to pick something that makes no sense, but that's what they picked, and the question is whether the agency has to stick with that or can dump it.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to go too far down the merits. Again, those have not been adjudicated
right,
by the board, but I do want to point out that the statute says that the agency is to use the most current data available.
Right, we're on a different subject. My question is, are there hospitals that arrange their own allocation of patients based on what they thought was a fixed number? Who, if it now turns out that number is not fixed, might be disadvantaged. They made business decisions. They built things. They put in operating rooms or they didn't. They brought in students to study or they didn't, based on what they understood how much they would be reimbursed for. And
yes,
if that's,
I think that's
changed,
right.
Would that, for some of them anyway, would it be a disadvantage to them?
I think that is a real possibility, Your Honor, yes.
Where in the record is that explanation?
It doesn't say that, Your Honor, but it does say that the Secretary did note both the Medicare programs and providers' interest in repose and these issues. And it goes on to note in response to the comments that say, well, you're just throwing accuracy under the bus and we don't think this is the way to go. They explained that at some point, both providers and the Medicare program should be able to close their books and know what a fixed number is.
I don't discount that, but as I said to the plaintiff's counsel, I don't really see that explained in the way Chief Judge Garland just explained it. He did a better explanation than I see in what the agency did. I don't see this spelled out in terms of the sky is falling repercussions. I just see a conclusory repose balanced against accuracy, and I don't know if it's hard or not hard to change these things. Maybe certain ones can be changed and certain ones can't. Maybe we shouldn't allow any of them to be changed because, but I don't see the because explained.
Well, Your Honor, I think the Secretary thought that by noting the problems of stale evidence against the backdrop of Regents, which noted that was a problem even for a 5-year gap, And here, of course, the Secretary is looking back over 30 years to all sorts of predicate facts that have been determined along the way for different statutory regimes, mm-hmm. and said there is a problem that documents are no longer available, witnesses are no longer available, and at JA 1317, the Secretary does clearly spell out that concern. And so I think that the agency's path on this point is reasonable and reasonably discerned. I think if the agency had wanted to, it could have said something along the lines of what Judge Garland just articulated, but I do not think it was required to in order to sustain this rulemaking.
Just following up on this point, under the law as it existed post-Kaiser but before the regulatory amendment, wasn't the pre-existing law that providers could use appeals to challenge predicate facts?
In the circuit between 2013
right,
and
2017. Right, because that's what happened in Kaiser itself.
It is.
So to the extent the law is being changed in a way that might upset hospital planning, I would think that's a problem with the regulation, not with – and the regulation makes that problem worse by changing the law as it existed before.
Well, Your Honor, I think there was only a brief period when it was established under this court's within the circuit. Of course, this is a nationwide program
right.
that folks could get review long after the fact of this type of predicate determination.
Were there a lot of cases either pre-Kaiser or in circuits other than this one post-Kaiser where providers used appeals to challenge predicate facts and were tossed out on the ground that even before this amendment they couldn't do that?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of them, but I think that the backdrop rule was articulated in the regulation, or the backdrop rule as the Secretary understood it, and I don't want to be seen as trying to relitigate Kaiser.
No, I understand. Right.
The circuit went the other way, but the whole premise there of the argument was that the provider understood this to be closed and that we couldn't go back and re-audit.
It just seems that when the preamble says that was the traditional that was our traditional understanding, they're awfully thin on examples and statutory or regulatory sites.
It does not give, I think the example it gives is the statement in the graduate medical education rulemaking at issue in Regions, that had been how they always understood it to be. That certainly was the understanding the provider there was resting its claim on, like, this is closed, it's been 3 years, you can't take it back.
Okay.
And Kaiser involved a reopening and not an appeal?
I believe Kaiser involved board appeals that the Secretary argued were cut off by the reopening regulation, and this court said that the reopening regulation did not at that time cut off that type of, did not actually apply at all to the predicate fact determinations.
So was the agency's reason for changing the reopening section that the only section that was being attacked by the court was the reopening section?
I believe so, Your Honor. That was the problem this court identified, and in the preamble it explained that it was undertaking this rulemaking because of this court's Kaiser decision and because it needed to fix its regulation.
There was no reference to the language of the appeal regulation in Kaiser.
No, but throughout the rulemaking, the Secretary actually does talk about 1315.
No, in the Kaiser case. The court doesn't discuss the language.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
You're saying that Kaiser was an appeal and not a reopening?
Yes. It was an appeal, and it was, I think, conceded that if you counted the appeal, the 180-day appeal limit, from the date of the latter-day decisions they were challenging, that they were timely in that sense. Our argument was that, well, no, because you're outside the three-year period to reopen predicate facts, what you're complaining about happened long before these cost reports. And of course, that's the argument we lost, and that's what we were trying to fix vis-a-vis this
right,
rulemaking.
What I'm asking is, was there an argument made in the Kaiser litigation that the appeals regulation was the only one that should have been considered because it was an appeal, and that the appeals regulation permitted going back to the earlier predicate facts?
Not that I know of. It's certainly not reflected in the opinion, Your Honor.
What do we do if the one question. If we think the text of the regulation is clear and the preamble is also clear.
Clear in which direction, Your Honor?
The opposite direction. What do we do in that circumstance, in your view?
both the preamble and the text clearly say that appeals can go forward?
No, they say the opposite thing. Say the preamble is clear in one direction, the text of a regulation is clear in the other direction.
If you mean clear in the sense that our interpretation is inconsistent with the with the regulations text, then I think that you would say that this does not apply to appeals, and you would remand to the agency for further proceedings. I want to stress that.
So it really turns on the clarity or ambiguity of the regulation, whether we can bring the preamble into it.
But I think if the regulation is ambiguous in any sense,
correct,
then that it is properly read through the lens of the final rule in which it was announced. And against the backdrop of the Kaiser decision, which is what this entire rulemaking was brought in response to.
Well, do you think the text of the regulation can become ambiguous because of a prior court decision?
No, but I think that the Secretary's reference to the period at issue being at issue in an appeal or a reopening, and I know that I may be refighting a battle with Judge Katsas here,
So that parenthetical is your hook for ambiguity.
I think it's certainly the strongest evidence of it, Your Honor. I do want to note.
Is there any other evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that it's the, if you look at the predicate fact, the fact that specific finding on matter at issue, this is what you can reopen with respect to, now includes a predicate fact, and you say, okay, how do you start the clock on that? Okay, if you're challenging a predicate fact, you start from the date when that predicate fact was first determined. I think the structure also suggests the result that the agency thought it had accomplished here. So I think both that parenthetical and the overall structure of how reopening works did what the agency clearly said she thought she was doing.
Let me ask it one final way, which is, do you think a clear parenthetical can create ambiguity in an otherwise contradictory but clear text?
I'm not sure I followed all of the adjectives in that sentence, but the parenthetical is...
Let me phrase it clearly. The text is clear, and you say the text contradicts the preamble. Can that fact mean that we can say, actually, the text is ambiguous, not clear?
Which fact, Your Honor? The fact of the parenthetical?
Mm-hmm.
The parenthetical is part of the text, Your Honor. So
now
I think...
Let me try it again. If the text of a regulation, is, we think, clear and goes against the government, the preamble is in favor of the government. Can we use the preamble to say that the text of the regulation actually isn't so clear but is ambiguous?
I'm not sure you could, Your Honor. If you think that this regulatory text is unambiguously does not accomplish the result we think it does, I think then that the preamble can't be used to create ambiguity. I think that we think at minimum...
I think that's right.
This regulation... we think it unambiguously puts predicate facts on the three-year line, and that is what Judge Bates determined. However, if you thought that it was not unambiguous in our favor, we think at minimum it is
ambiguous. Right. No, I got that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I know the other side is out of time, but we will give the other side 2 minutes anyway.
Just two or three key points I'd like to make, Your Honor. First, the court spent a lot of time with government counsel discussing the text of the regulation and the meaning and that sort of thing. And I want to point you to the regulation itself, the December 10th, 2013 Federal Register, because I think it's instructive about why we're having this debate. In your joint appendix, it's at page 1313. And 1317. Secretary, after the discussion about the purpose of the rule as a whole, says, finally, although we proposed revisions only to 405.1885, in order to clarify our regulations in accordance with this proposal, we stated that we were considering making similar changes regarding predicate facts to the regulations governing intermediary appeals at 405.1811 and appeals to the board at 405.1835.
What Federal Register page are you on?
Okay, 75165, the third column.
75165, okay, sorry.
Third column, first full paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
So they note at that point that they contemplated and were contemplating making similar changes to the PRB appeals regulation at 405.1835. And then at the conclusion of the regulation on page 75169 of the Federal Register, It says, at this time, we have decided not to make similar changes regarding predicate facts to the regulations governing intermediary appeals at 405.1811 and appeals to the board at 405.1835. Now, we don't acknowledge that the secretary would have had the authority to do that. We absolutely reject that. But certainly the secretary could have been more clear by amending or attempting to amend the regulation. That's the reason that the secretary's interpretation is completely contrary to the text of the regulation, and this court owes no deference to that kind of interpretation. I wanted to also mention one of the arguments that council made to support sort of the reasonableness of the regulation is that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We're applying this regulation to ourselves as well. And at page 75164 of the Federal Register in the middle column, it says, in talking about applying this rule, it says, however, we recognize exceptions when a particular legal provision of the Medicare statute, regulations, or CMS rulings authorizes, as part of a specific rule, the review and revision of a predicate fact after the expiration of the three-year rule. So there's a hole big enough for the government to drive its truck through, and we don't think that's any evidence that the regulation is reasonable. If the court agrees with us that that the regulation is invalid and is inappropriately applied to these hospitals, I want to emphasize that we filed our first appeals in 2005. We've been in this administrative process for 13 years almost. The remedy that we've asked for in our pleadings is for the court to order the secretary to recalculate the standardized amount by removing the discharge transfer amount from discharges. If the court was otherwise disposed to remand the case for some general sort of further proceedings, I would simply ask that the agency be directed to use whatever resources are available to determine how to correct that standardized amount. The secretary did acknowledge the error, despite the council's statements. Second, in the Federal Register, it says there is a discrepancy. We didn't make this adjustment. We don't know today the exact magnitude or the exact way to fix it, but there has to be a way that it's fixable, and so we would ask for some instructions.
What happened after Kaiser with respect to the petitioners and Kaiser?
What happened after? They were paid under the new
they were allowed to look back at the predicate facts?
I didn't understand the question.
In what way were they paid? Were they allowed to go back and recalculate whatever the predicate? I can't remember what the predicate fact was in Kaiser. But
yeah, I think it was the GME cost. FDA correct. Cap, and so yeah. They were able to, they found an error in their base year, but they didn't identify that error until after 3 years had passed from the reopening. It was the very same issue that the government successfully changed in the Regions case. They went back and revisited the base year for GME in the Regions case and did it, they argued, under the authority of a regulation. But that's what the plaintiffs in Kaiser were requesting, an adjustment to their GME base year, and this court agreed. And so my understanding is they were paid that GME base year was corrected so that the caps were raised, and they received additional reimbursement just for the years that were on appeal.
Do you have any sense of how much money is involved?
In our case, hundreds of millions, a lot of money, Your Honor.
Okay, further questions? All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Thanks to both sides.